and pull back too much on our mitigation policy.
Michigan is averaging upwards of 5,000 new cases a day, and the governor there is asking for more vaccines. What do you think of that idea of having the federal government take vaccine from less hard-hit places and send it to hot spots? Or is that not necessary at this point?
Well, I'm not. I don't know if you could say it's not necessary, but what is happening is that the distribution is being put very much the responsibility at the local level, giving governors and mayors and others to move around within the state. As far as we know, the allocation per state still remains at the pro rata level, where you do it on the basis of population. Now, that could change, but right now, we're looking at the possibility of the states themselves making a redistribution depending upon where they're seeing the surge.
How do you think we're doing on the pace of vaccinations? It sounds like you're optimistic, you're positive. Could it be going any faster, though?
You know, you could always do things a little faster, but for example, we're likely going to be over 30 million vaccinations this past week. That is really good. And what we're doing, and it just was announced yesterday, that there's a thing called the COVID Community Core. What we're doing is to get trusted messengers in the community and giving them the necessary information to go out and get people to get up there and get vaccinated as soon as vaccine becomes available to them. So it's a rather big push. It just started yesterday. It's a public education campaign, and it's referred to as the COVID-19 Community Core. I think that will accelerate the distribution of vaccines. I'm pretty optimistic that that will be value added.
I want to talk about something that you've just alluded to, which is that in some places there still is vaccine skepticism. You know, Donald Trump and people in his administration who downplayed the pandemic are no longer in power. Our colleague Ping Huang has been reporting on how the CDC is trying to rebuild public trust. The Biden administration certainly has been letting science speak. You are one of the most prominent voices, but it just seems like a lot of people aren't listening. I'm thinking of reporting that we did over spring break where lots of kids headed down to Florida. I'm thinking of, like you said, local officials lifting mask mandates. Why do you think that is? Why isn't the message getting through?
Well, I think there are several factors that are coming in here now. I think in general, we have what we're referring to as COVID-19 fatigue. This has been going on now for, you know, 14 to 15 months.
Sure.
And people are just fatigued at that. We can't give up. And that's the reason why the messaging that I and my colleagues do all the time is that we need to hang in there just a bit longer. We are going to get through this. We are going to get this behind us for absolutely certain. The one thing we don't want to do is pull back prematurely. But you're right. I mean, it's not easy to get people who've been going through this for such a long period of time to say, I'm not going to go on a spring break and I'm not going to take a vacation. Everybody wants to do that. But I'm telling you, I believe strongly that every day that goes by, we get closer and closer to getting an advantage. And that means the vaccines that are being distributed at over 3 million per day is going to get us to the end game where we want to be.
With all of the vaccines and all of the cases, do you think we might be approaching herd immunity? I know that's a difficult question to answer. I'm just curious.
Yeah,
think about where we stand.
You know, it's an elusive terminology.
Yes,
because we don't know exactly with this particular virus what herd immunity would mean. You know, herd immunity means you get enough people who are immune, either from prior infections, which would render them to be immune, or vaccine. Putting those two together, you reach a certain critical level in the community where people are protected, that you really, the virus has no place to go. I mean, obviously, the more people you get vaccinated, the more people that successfully recover from COVID-19, the greater number of people you'll have to contribute to this concept of herd immunity. Since we don't know exactly what that number is, you just have to keep trying to get as many people vaccinated as you possibly can, add it to the people who have recovered from infection would also contribute to that herd immunity.
And lastly, in the seconds we have left, what's your message for people who are going to get together this weekend for Easter?
You know, enjoy the holiday, but continue to abide by the public health measures. You know, if you're vaccinated, and you're in a family setting, you can do a lot of things. You can get together without a mask and have a good time.
But still be careful. Dr. Anthony Fauci, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
More than 300 people have now been charged in the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. Many of them openly expressed extreme political views before heading to Washington. So now in different parts of the country, local law enforcement are asking whether they should be keeping track of potentially dangerous people. Colorado Public Radio's Allison Sherry reports.
They posted plans to go to D.C. on Facebook. They were members of local paramilitary groups and talked to friends and family and even the media about a stolen election that they intended to go fight against in person.
Pelosi, the Clintons, all of them, every single one of them, Biden, Kamala, they have completely destroyed our country.
This is Robert Gieswein in an interview ahead of January 6th by ITV. He is one of the five Coloradans so far charged in storming the U.S. Capitol. But even though Gieswein talked openly about his conspiracy theories, what happened on January 6th surprised local law enforcement officers.
I don't know a whole lot about them, if you want to know the truth, other than they show up and they do some different events for the U.S. flag.
That is Teller County Sheriff Jason Meixel, whose jurisdiction covers Woodland Park, where Gieswein lives.
That doesn't mean that they're doing anything wrong being a part of the jury.
Federal officials rely on local law enforcement to be their eyes and ears in communities. They hold regular briefings with local agencies and share intelligence. But FBI Director Chris Wray recently told Congress they don't have good enough sources in communities.
So anytime there's an attack, you can be darn tootin' that we are focused very, very hard on how can we get better sources, better information, so that we can make sure that something like what happened on January 6th never happens again.
Law enforcement agencies have to make decisions about how they scatter their resources. And it's clear now that times have changed. They are now being asked to shoulder a whole new responsibility. In conservative western Colorado, Mesa County Undersheriff Todd Rowell takes a notably personal approach.
Early on, we try to contact that individual and sit down with them to see if it's someone that's just making statements in a polarized environment, or are they taking substantial steps to commit criminal activity?
Rowell says he has deputies mostly monitoring social media sites where people share plans that could mean trouble. Even though his community has more than 100,000 people, Undersheriff Rowell treats it like a small town.
We know the people that live on those fringes. I'd be shocked if somebody gave us a call to tell us about somebody and one of our 250 employees didn't know who that person was.
The feds are clearly grappling with how organized and dangerous those groups really are. Prosecutors said this week they consider some dangerous enough to possibly charge with sedition. A Colorado federal judge recently compared the three percenters, an anti-government group, to a criminal street gang. One local sheriff tries to make a sharp distinction, though.
You don't blame those organizations for the behavior of a few. You blame the few.
That's suburban Douglas County Sheriff Tony Spurlock, who says he's seen bad actors hide inside what he calls political organizations and then mask illegal activity with free speech.
Black Lives Matter, clearly a political organization. Proud Boys, clearly a political organization. And that's where law enforcement has to monitor very delicately, because both of those groups will come after you about interfering in their First Amendment rights.
As the federal government continues its largest domestic terrorism probe, it has become clear that in order to be successful in thwarting another attack, they're going to need local law enforcement to play a key role. For NPR News, I'm Allison Sherry in Denver.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 6:19, and it is Friday. Later this hour, we'll hear Wisconsin Life. Today, we'll hear about a converted former bank that's now a space for musicians and artists. A story from The Heist in 25 minutes.
Hi there, it's Rachel Martin from NPR News. I am proud to work with stations around the country, including WPR, to bring you news that you can trust. We search out the backstory, give voice to the diversity of our nation, question along with you, and share moments of beauty, moments of joy. This comprehensive reporting is possible thanks to listener contributions. Be a part of this important work when you give at WPR.org. Thanks.
Support for WPR comes from the Century House, featuring Herman Miller furniture and stressless Norwegian recliners on University Avenue in Madison, furnishing homes and offices since 1948. CenturyHouseInc.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, college students are eligible for food stamps through SNAP for up to $234 per month to help with groceries due to the pandemic. You don't have to work to be eligible, and students who receive no financial support and those who are eligible for work study should apply. Wisconsin.gov.
Sunny skies across Wisconsin today. Breezy in the north. We'll have highs from the upper 40s to the mid-50s. On Saturday, continued sunny for the region with highs in the mid to upper 60s. And on Sunday, mostly sunny in the south. A mix of sun and clouds for the rest of the state. A few sprinkles in the northeast. Highs ranging from the upper 30s in the north to, that's the upper 50s in the north to the low 70s in the south.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org. From Charlie Kirker, a member of the NPR Foundation Board of Trustees, working to help provide the highest quality public service journalism to communities across the USA. From iDrive with Remote PC, providing remote access to PCs, Macs, and servers from anywhere, assisting those working from home, and also enabling remote assistance for customers at remotepc.com. And from Americans for the Arts.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Noelle King. Good morning. Do the trillions of dollars that the Biden administration wants to pump into the economy signal the return of big government? I put this question to Zachary Carter, who wrote a book called The Price of Peace. It's about the economist John Maynard Keynes and the ideas that underpin our current understanding of what government's responsibility is in a time of crisis. Carter told me it's not really about big government versus small government anymore. It's about how the money is spent.
There's always been, at least over the last 75 years, a fairly large government. But since the 1990s, there has been a different consensus about how we should organize that government, with Democrats moving closer to sort of the Reagan conservative Republican understanding about how the state should be organized. And I think President Biden's been pretty clear about wanting to turn away from that. He's hanging a large portrait of FDR in the Oval Office. That's something new. So I think the size of the government is sort of a rhetorical issue. The real shift here is where the focus of that government is directed.
I'm going to phrase this next question carefully because I know that authors of New York Times op-eds often don't write the headlines. You wrote in an op-ed in the New York Times that coronavirus killed the gospel of small government. What did you mean by that?
Well, I do want to credit the headline writers of the Times. That was their headline, but I approve of the headline. I think the gospel of small government has always been divorced from the reality of what conservatives have called big government. The belief that with the government out of the way, the economy will take care of itself, and that individuals acting of their own sort of rational impetus, self-interest, will do things that are productive and prosperous. I think one of the important lessons, perhaps the most important lesson from the work of John Maynard Keynes, is that oftentimes individuals, for their own quite rational reasons, decide to do things that are bad for the economy as a whole. If everybody stops spending, then nobody is buying any goods and producers have to lay people off. If the economy is bad, right, if things look pretty rough for the future, then it can be quite rational for everybody to save. So you need someone, some entity, to step in and coordinate this activity to give people confidence that the future is going to be brighter than today and give them the power to act on that.
Did the era of small government lead us to problems that were hidden, that the pandemic then exposed?
I think so. I think most of these problems, however, were exposed during and after the financial crisis of 2008. I mean, this sort of way of thinking about the economy that the Biden administration is deploying is not new. It was very popular in the United States between the 1930s and the 1970s, but it has been out of fashion, certainly for the past 25 years, and I think really for most of the past 50 years. And so people could see that things were not working correctly or as well as they would have hoped in 2009 and 2010. But there was still this sort of belief that if the government got out of the way, the private sector would take care of these problems. And there are just some problems that the private sector not only can't take care of, but needs the government's help to solve. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is a conservative and I think broadly Republican Party aligned institution. It's an organization of big business executives. And that organization has been pushing for a large infrastructure bill for quite some time now, even though it constitutes big government spending.
But this is an interesting point you make about the Chamber of Commerce, a normally very conservative organization, asking for government intervention. Does that suggest to you that broadly minds are starting to change about what the role of government is?
I do think so. I mean, I think politicians use ideas more cynically than ordinary people do. So there will be, I don't want to say that the Chamber of Commerce and the Senate under Mitch McConnell is going to be acting like a wing of FDR's New Deal coalition. I think when they see opportunities for conservative goals to be advanced, they will take them. But you can even look at the way Mitch McConnell has responded to this proposal for an infrastructure bill to see evidence of a shift here. McConnell isn't saying $3 trillion is a terrible thing that the government can't afford and that it will all be wasted. He's opposed to raising taxes on predominantly on the wealthy in order to pay for it. So he's still seeing this in a sort of conservative frame. He's looking out for the wealthy and also trying to avert tax increases. But he's not so worried about the government spending money, and he's not so worried about government debt and deficits. I think that is a change that you're going to see reflected broadly in the way both parties approach governing over the next few years.
Zachary Carter is the author of The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. Zach, thanks for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Noel.
Roy Williams says it's time to say goodbye. The legendary college men's basketball coach is retiring. Here's North Carolina Public Radio's Dave DeWitt.
Fans of UNC Chapel Hill basketball like to talk about the Carolina family, the group of former players and coaches that started with legendary coach Dean Smith and includes icons like Michael Jordan. On Thursday, Roy Williams stepped down as the program's leader.
It has been unbelievable. I've loved it. It's coaching. And that's all I've ever wanted to do since the summer after my ninth grade year in high school.
Williams came to UNC as an undersized, hardworking teenager from Asheville. He played junior varsity basketball, served as a student assistant, and then as an assistant coach. He even sold team calendars in the summer to supplement his then middling salary. After 10 years as an assistant, Williams took the head coaching job at Kansas. In 2003, a few years after Dean Smith had retired, Williams was the top candidate to take over at Carolina. A CBS reporter asked Williams about it right after Kansas lost the national title game.
I got to think that in tough times that people should be more sensitive. I could give a shit about North Carolina right now.
That sentiment was short-lived, and a few weeks later, Williams left Kansas to come back home to Chapel Hill. He won 3 national titles in 18 years. And was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame in 2007.
I've been the luckiest guy alive. My family at home, my family on the court. No one has been more fortunate than me.
Williams ends his career as the third winningest men's Division I college basketball coach ever. North Carolina did not announce a possible replacement. Many fans will demand it be someone else from the Carolina basketball family, but it will be impossible to find someone with blood as blue as Roy Williams. For NPR News, I'm Dave DeWitt.
It's NPR News.
Asian Americans and Black Americans have a shared history of solidarity, a political alignment that's emerged in spite of the two communities' differences.
We are interested in racial antagonism between Black and Asian folks. However, what we see time and time again is that we also work in concert against racial injustice.
How the two movements reinforce one another this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered starts at 4 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
When Morning Edition on WPR. We'll have the latest news for you in just a moment, including the details of this story. One of the candidates for Wisconsin's state superintendent says she would not support trans students competing on single-sex sports teams. Details coming up.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Employers in the U.S. added 916,000 jobs last month as more Americans received COVID-19 vaccinations and more states lifted restrictions. NPR's Chris Arnold says the nation's unemployment rate fell to 6%.
Nearly a million job gains is a big number and stronger than many economists were expecting. Construction in particular saw a lot of hiring with a gain of 110,000 jobs. Manufacturing also saw strong gains. However, while the economy is clearly rebounding, the country is still down around 8.5 million jobs compared to before the pandemic. So it's likely to take into next year to rehire the number of people who lost their jobs after the coronavirus hit. And of course, much depends on not having another big wave of infections, which could set back the return towards normal for restaurants, stadiums, dentist offices, and all kinds of other businesses. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
The Biden administration is planning to take part in next week's talks in Austria on the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement. The U.S. withdrew from the deal in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Tehran under then-President Trump. Parties to the agreement include Britain, France, and Germany. A statement from the group earlier today says they would welcome the U.S. rejoining the deal. A train crash in Taiwan today has killed at least 48 people. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. As coronavirus cases rise in Wisconsin, regulators overseeing healthcare professionals are weighing in with resolutions encouraging vaccination. Shemaine Mills reports.
The Medical Examining Board and the Board of Nursing have passed strong statements urging their colleagues and the public to get vaccinated against COVID-19. The chair for the Medical Examining Board is Dr. Sheldon Wasserman.
You know, we're on board. We want to make sure everybody knows that, and we want to make sure the message is clear-cut, very solid, that we support these vaccines, that we ourselves are getting these vaccines.
The state does not track vaccinations by profession. However, hospitals and other healthcare employers say between 60 and 90% of caregivers have been vaccinated so far. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
One of the candidates in the state superintendent race says her opponent's stance on trans children in sports is transphobic. Both candidates were asked about recent bills that would limit student athletes to the teams aligning with their gender assigned at birth. Former Brown Deer superintendent Deborah Kerr, who has played and coached sports, says she would support those policies.
I participated in sports, and I know that many parents are concerned about this kind of thinking. They want their girls participating against other girls, and it has nothing to do with transphobia.
Pecatonica Superintendent Jill Underley says that is transphobic and she would not support those bills.
I guess I'm just taken a little bit aback by that. Trans kids are kids, plain and simple, and they deserve to feel safe and welcome in our school.
The election for state superintendent is Tuesday. There were 517 new cases of the coronavirus registered by state health officials yesterday, with three new deaths reported. The seven-day average yesterday was 468 cases, according to the Department of Health Services. In mid-March, the seven-day average was below 400 cases. 6,625 Wisconsin residents have died of the virus since the start of the pandemic. DHS says 18.5% of the state's population is fully vaccinated, including 60% of people age 65 and older. The state health agency also announced it was giving $6.2 million to more than 100 agencies around the state representing underserved people of color to improve vaccine access. This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio. There's more on our website at WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from C3AI. C3AI software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable problems. C3AI, this is Enterprise AI. And from the Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, where a career-spanning survey of Alexander Calder's art is now on view in the galleries and sculpture garden. Timed tickets available at moma.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm Rachel Martin. The U.S. job market appears to be in full bloom this spring. This morning, the Labor Department reported that U.S. employers added 916,000 jobs last month. That's the strongest gain since August. Job gains for January and February were also revised upwards. NPR's Scott Horsley is with us. Scott, good morning.
Good morning, Rachel.
I love good news on a Friday. I mean, this is a big deal, right? What's behind it?
Rachel, consumers have more money in their pockets. The federal government's been sending out those $1,400 relief payments, and they also have more places to spend it. As coronavirus restrictions are relaxed around the country, and as vaccinations are multiplying, people feel more comfortable eating out and shopping. We've seen increased traffic at restaurants and retail shops. That means more hiring in those businesses. It's the opposite of what we saw during the fall and winter when consumers were locking down and jobs were drying up. This is how Neela Richardson puts it. She's the chief economist at the big payroll processing firm ADP.
The labor market recovery has awakened from its winter slump when there was a surge in new COVID cases in the last 3 months of 2020.
We also saw more schools reopening in March, and that means hiring more bus drivers and lunchroom workers and classroom aides. And construction companies did a lot of hiring as the weather improved after those bad winter storms back in February.
The unemployment rate fell last month, too. It fell to 6%. Where does all this put the overall jobs recovery?
Yeah, unemployment was down by 0.2, which is good. And it's also encouraging that more than 300,000 people joined the workforce last month. Some of those people might have been sitting out the pandemic in earlier months, not looking for work during the wintertime. Mm-hmm. The labor force participation rate, which we watched pretty closely, inched up just a bit. We still got a long way to go to get back to full employment, though. Of the 22 million jobs that were lost a year ago when the pandemic took hold in the U.S., we have so far recovered about 62%, so that leaves about 8.4 million jobs to go. So, you know, March was certainly a good month for the job market. We need 8 or 9 or 10 more good months just like it.
How likely are we to get that?
We could see a continued surge. There's certainly a lot of pent-up demand out there. People who've kept their jobs during this period have saved up a lot of money, and we could see a surge in travel and entertainment and all the things people haven't been able to do for the last year as right. people feel comfortable. But as Neela Richardson says, that all depends on keeping the pandemic in check.
The continuation of this jobs recovery will depend largely on continued improvement and the containment of the virus through vaccination and other measures.
This report is actually a snapshot of what was going on in the middle of March. In the weeks since then, we have seen an uptick in new coronavirus cases and hospitalizations. We also saw an increase last week in new claims for unemployment. So as Dr. Fauci told Morning Edition today, it's a race between efforts to get more people vaccinated and protected from the pandemic and the evolution of the virus to become more resistant. And the winner of that race is going to determine both our public health outlook and the health of the U.S. job market.
NPR's chief economics correspondent, Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
For almost a year, the Trump administration sidelined and contradicted the CDC. And so while it is fighting the biggest public health challenge it's ever faced, that agency is also working to rebuild trust with the American public. For the past few weeks, NPR's Ping Huang has been talking to people at the CDC about what that's been like. Ping is with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Who have you been talking to?
Well, I've been talking with people who have been working in the CDC response since the very first COVID cases were found. I've also spoken with Dr. Rochelle Walensky. She's the current CDC director, and she took on that role in January. And the thing that I heard over and over is that even though the CDC may not have been visible for much of the pandemic, they've been working very hard. Here's Peggy Honane, who started working in the response last February.
You mentioned that you haven't always heard our voice, and I just want to emphasize that the work has continued every day of the response.
Honane, for instance, leads a task force that supports states and tribes and territories, and during the pandemic, they've made more than 3,000 trips out to states and local health departments to help with things like training and contact tracing and investigating COVID outbreaks.
But their lack of visibility during much of the pandemic, that's probably had real consequences, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, under the Trump administration, the CDC's advice on things like tests and masking was often ignored or, like you said, even contradicted. And the CDC itself made some early mistakes. And those things have all seriously eroded public trust. Here's CDC Director Rochelle Walensky.
I think that it's really a shame that we in this country can't all agree that it would be a good thing to not have infection in this country. It would be a good thing to not have deaths, and that if you wear masks, you can prevent infection. I think we inherited an unfortunate situation there.
And the agency needs the public to trust them and to do what they recommend to end this pandemic. So rebuilding that trust is one of their top priorities.
How do they plan to do that?
Well, first, Walensky has pledged that the agency will be transparent. I mean, one of the things that's been confusing to the public is why their advice changes. You know, why, for instance, did physical distancing shrink from 6 feet to 3 feet in schools? And she says they're going to be clear about the science they're using to drive their decisions. They've actually recently reviewed the website and removed some information put up during the Trump administration days that wasn't authorized by its scientists. And the other key thing now is that the CDC's messaging is in lockstep with the Biden-Harris administration. So getting political interference out of it has been a huge help. But Dr. Ali Khan, a former CDC official, told me that that isn't their only problem.
My caution for the agency is that they don't lump all of their troubles under politicization of the response. There are fundamental issues that need to be fixed about public health in America and that need to be fixed at CDC.
He says that they've made missteps on testing and mask guidance and that public health in the U.S. has been ignored and underfunded for many, many years.
When you put that charge to people at the CDC, what did they say?
Well, Walensky said that it's true. Their record is not perfect, and they will be reviewing the mistakes that they've made and figuring out how to do better in the future. But for now, they're focused on the many challenges ahead. They're working with states to get those COVID vaccines out both quickly and equitably. They're tracking the spread of coronavirus variants. And Dr. Henry Wok, the leader of the CDC's COVID response, says that one of the biggest things they're facing right now is pandemic fatigue.
CDC certainly has a role, but it also requires the whole U.S. government and basically all American citizens really to contribute to the control.
Walk says that it's going to take everyone pulling in the same direction to make it possible for all of us, including the 8,000 people at CDC who've been working in the response, to get our normal lives back.
8,000 people. NPR health reporter Ping Huang, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio, and here are some of the day's stories in the news. Christians in the Holy Land are marking Good Friday this year amid signs of the coronavirus crisis may be winding down. Religious sites in the Holy Land are open, but there will be none of the mass pilgrimages usually seen in the Holy Week leading up to Easter. Last year, Jerusalem was under a strict lockdown. North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum has declared a statewide fire emergency after a wildfire in Billings County caused the city of Medora to be evacuated. Burgum says the North Dakota National Guard would deploy two Black Hawk helicopters to assist in battling the blaze. Interstate 94 was temporarily closed. The state has seen a growing number of wildfires with extreme drought conditions across the state. And Wisconsin's largest business lobby has filed a lawsuit against the Wisconsin DNR over the so-called forever chemicals known as PFAS. More on that coming up just after 9.
WPR's news, conversation, and music is packed with insights, information, and inspiration to keep you connected and engaged all day long. And now it's even easier to play us on your Amazon smart speaker. Install the WPR skill today, and you'll be on your way. Find instructions at wpr.org/speaker.
Support for WPR comes from All of Us Wisconsin, dedicated to helping speed up health research breakthroughs by asking 1 million people to share health information. Details at joinallofus.org/Wisconsin.
Support comes from Kenosha County ADRC, now offering regional medical trips. Kenosha County residents may make a reservation for rides to medical appointments in Walworth, Racine, and Milwaukee counties. $15 one way. Reservations are required one day in advance. Call 262-658-9093.
Morning Edition on WPR, and here's what's coming up. Apparently, it is not too early for ice cream. Jack Bishop of America's Test Kitchen offers some very unconventional ice cream toppings for your Easter table. That's coming up in 9 minutes. The forecast for today, sunny skies across Wisconsin, breezy in the north, highs from the upper 40s to mid-50s, and on Saturday, continued sunny for the region with highs in the mid to upper 60s.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from iDrive, providing cloud backup, full system backup, and on-site iDrive appliance to protect PCs, Macs, and servers from data loss due to crashes and ransomware. At iDrive.com/NPR. From the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's 8:45 now and time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a central Wisconsin community space.
There's a place in Ripon that's providing a space for musicians and artists to get as creative as they want to. At the Heist, organizers have converted a former bank into a community space that they hope will bring people together. Aisha Jaffer recently spent a weekend there and introduces us to the makers at the Heist.
Sam Luna is a musician, creator, and educator. He's traveled across the nation searching for his artistic home in places like New Mexico and LA, with the goal of starting a project that amplifies a greater artist community.
I'd always wanted to be a part of an art project. You know, I really thought that talking about Wisconsin, I find myself more inspired here than most places I go to.
It was actually love that brought Luna to Wisconsin, but his passion for the creative community keeps him here. His first experience was in Kenosha, booking shows from music to spoken word. It's also where he found music.
I quit a job one day without even thinking about it. I had written one song and figured I would just try it. And that was 15 years ago. And that's where I started doing music and art.
Well, I've been on the road for 10 years now.
Sam's music took him all around the state, but when he was asked to play in Ripon, he had no idea his life was about to change.
So I took the road in, turned the corner, saw this building, and I got goosebumps. I saw the downtown, really beautiful community. There's only been, you know, three places that have made me feel that way in all the different travels.
Sam became fascinated with that building. A year later, he acquired what is now the art space known as the Heist. Before this, the building had taken on many forms as an opera house, venue, and a bank. Its time as a bank tied directly into a piece of Luna's family history and his grandmother.
She played music, some jazz music at night, rob banks during the day. She found herself in a situation where she thought the only way to provide for herself or her family was through robbing a bank. And here came an opportunity to be able to take a bank and give it back to the community.
I had the pleasure of spending the night at the Heist, and inspiration was radiating throughout its walls.
It's a place to create, inspire, educate, and collaborate, and using those in every bit of the arts, through food, through textiles, through music, through art, through community, a place to be able to come together, learn together, and inspire each other. That's really what I want people to come in and feel from the space.
During my stay, I was able to speak to some of the talent who are currently using the space, like musician Tay of Green Bay.
It makes it more colorful here, and I don't mean that like just in an artistic way. I think that the diversity that we bring in from different people from different cultures and just different mindsets, people aren't used to that here. And so I think that's like one of the most valuable parts.
While Tay rehearses with her band in the main lobby, I find Aaron Dusterheff in another part of the building called the Hideout. He's the resident audio engineer and recording Tay from one level above us.
I've met so many people doing this project that I would never have. I've dabbled in art the way I never have. It brings people together in a really intangible way, I guess.
during this pandemic. Luna says the Heist continues to support and highlight the artist community all throughout Wisconsin.
Musicians, artists, sound engineers, lighting crew. There are so many different people that are affected with this shutdown that are involved with the arts. And remember that each individual person is a small business. And so let's find ways to come together to help those small businesses. And I think that's what the goal of this space is to do, is try and gather people together and help, even if it's to bring awareness.
That story on the Heist in Ripon came to us from Aisha Jaffer, a storyteller based in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It's Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support comes from the Racine Symphony, presenting the Masterworks Concert Season Finale on Sunday, April 18th at 3 p.m., streamed live with no fee on the Symphony's YouTube channel, featuring Young Artist Competition winner Nolan Borner performing Saint-Saëns' Cello Concerto No. 1.
Accurate information to help you decipher what it means for you now and in the future. So listen to Morning Edition from NPR News every weekday.
It's Morning Edition on WPR. And in sports, the Milwaukee Brewers beat the Minnesota Twins on opening day yesterday, 6-5. The two teams play again tomorrow and Sunday. And the Bucks play the Trailblazers tonight at 9. In the weather forecast, sunny across Wisconsin today, breezy in the north. We'll have highs from the upper 40s to the mid-50s. On Saturday, continued sunny for the region, highs in the mid to upper 60s. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Noel King. Good morning. Here's a way to make Easter a little sweeter this year.
Ice cream, chillin', chillin', ice cream, chillin'. Ice cream, chillin', chillin', ice cream, chillin'.
It's hard to top an ice cream sundae on Easter Sunday, but that's exactly what Jack Bishop is going to do. Jack is one of the stars of the PBS TV show America's Test Kitchen. He's got the scoop on turning vanilla ice cream into a sweet and savory delicacy.
2020 was a year of eating a lot of ice cream at home. Ice cream sales were up 12% last year, which is a huge amount for an established category. Now, exotic flavors is the buzzword here. Not that I have any problems with hot fudge sauce and whipped cream, but we're kind of kicking it up a notch.
Okay, before we do any kicking, let's start with the basics. Picking your ice cream.
Basically, the world of ice cream lovers can be divided into two people. People who want quantity and people who want richness.
Oh.
Turkey Hill, which is in a big half-gallon container. This is for people who want their ice cream in quantity because it has a lot of air. It's called overrun.
I had no idea.
Well, they have to add air. So if you just took cream and milk and sugar and you froze it, you'd have basically an ice cube and you wouldn't be able to scoop it. But the Turkey Hill, it's actually 97% additional volume that comes from air. Now, for people who like richness, our top choice is Ben & Jerry's. So this one just has an additional 21% air. It's got twice as much fat because it's got a lot less air in it.
Jack joined me kitchen to kitchen over Zoom. Jack was in Boston. I was in Washington, D.C. with my dog, Guglielmo, who you will hear in the background. We tried 5 different ice cream toppings. And brace yourself because some of these sound gross. The first is everything bagel seasoning. It's a mixture of poppy seeds, garlic, and dried onion.
Garlic and onion on your ice cream?
Yes, I'm imagining onion flakes, and I'm thinking, who wants this? And yet,
here we are.
I'm approaching this with some consternation. You know, there is something nice about the savory spices balancing out the ice cream.
I like the crunch.
I like the crunch, too. The first bite or two, I was like, okay, I'm 70% there. And now I just keep eating it, which which I think is a sign that I'm sold.
Your love is better than ice cream, better than anything.
ice cream topping number two, extra virgin olive oil, and flaked sea salt.
So we're going to do a drizzle of extra virgin olive oil. And so this is, you know, a place to use the good stuff. And then a pinch of the sea salt on top of the ice cream. You're going to taste the olive oil in a way you've never tasted it before.
Okay, let me try. Oh, God, that is really good. This is delicious. And you're right. I'm used to using olive oil as kind of a cooking aid or mainly tasting it with, like, you know, on bread, on bruschetta, but it's great.
It's also very fruity. You know, olives are a fruit. We don't really think of them as a fruit, but it tastes much more fruity than it does in almost any other application.
This is a whole new world. I am really enjoying this.
Remember, pace yourself. We have more ice cream ahead of us.
I said one scoop, two scoops. Two scoops for me, please. Two scoops for me.
You ready for combination number three? Maple syrup and bacon. I know you're from maple syrup country, so you're using maple syrup, not pancake syrup, yes?
That is correct. Pure New York maple syrup.
All right, I'm using something from Vermont.
All right, let's dig in. Oh, God. That is dangerously good. This is why ice cream eatership went up 12%. Wow, this is amazing. Jack, you're going to give me a problem here, man.
I'm giving you solutions, not problems.
I'm your ice cream man. Stop me when I'm passing by. See, now all my flavors are guaranteed to satisfy. Hold on a second.
Next topping up, chopped salted peanuts and jam.
I'm using raspberry jam, and I'm going to put it in the microwave for maybe 10 or 15 seconds, just so that it's a little bit more fluid and more like a sauce.
I am using peach jalapeno jam that I got this summer. We'll see how this goes.
Again, we want a little bit of the saltiness, and also this is about crunch.
I think I do not have the right jam. I think this peach jalapeno situation is very good in some circumstances, but it's a little bit, with the peanuts, there's just too much flavor happening.
Yeah, that makes sense. This might actually be my least favorite combination so far. It's a little bit more expected than some of the other things we've tasted.
Our last ice cream topping was inspired by old world Italian cooking.
Go to a nice Italian restaurant, sometimes you'll finish the meal with a bowl of beautiful strawberries. And so we are going to sort of make a version of a strawberry topping with brown sugar, black pepper, vinegar, and then chopped strawberries.
Huh. I'm having a reaction. It takes a little getting used to.
You're tasting the sort of sour, tart, kind of woodsy notes, because, you know, balsamic vinegar is aged in wood casks. So I have to ask, do you have a favorite?
I am going to tell you that I think bacon and maple syrup is out of this world. That was by far my favorite. What was your favorite?
I love the olive oil and the flaked sea salt. That for me is a revelation.
Which one didn't work for you?
My least favorite was actually probably the jam and the salted peanuts. It wasn't that it didn't work, but I was kind of bored by it.
I'm with you on that.
So if you're thinking about, you know, something interesting at the end of a meal, put out multiple things and then let people do their own thing, right?
It's like Sunday bars when we were little and the cool kid would have a sleepover and the parents would just line up bowls of M&Ms and pretzels. And this is that, but for grown-ups. I love it. And we'll likely steal that idea and use it the next time I'm able to have people over.
Well, thanks for having, a power lunch here of five bowls of ice cream.
This was really fun. Thank you for joining us. And I hope we get a chance to do another one of these soon.
Great. Thank you. And don't eat any more ice cream.
Oh, God, no. I'm done. I'm so done. I think. I'm almost done. Jack Bishop hosts the PBS show America's Test Kitchen. Wishing all of you two big scoops of happiness this Easter. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Noel King.
And I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Melissa Ingalls. Special thanks to John Davis, who keeps the news flowing in the morning. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on WPR, and we'll have all the latest news from NPR and WPR for you every hour. Classical music with Stephanie Elkins is coming up.
Support for WPR comes from Wollersheim Winery and Distillery, producing several port wines, such as traditional red port, white port, and tawny port. Information about port wines and store hours at wollersheim.com.
WGTD-FM is now available on your smart speaker. Simply say, play WGTD on TuneIn and hear WGTD programming. 24/7 Jazz is also available. Simply ask, play WGTD HD2 on TuneIn.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.